This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 161.
Essence of self-awareness, which we all love, is not introspection, but is other awareness. If you want to understand yourself, which you said, it's very difficult to know who you really are. The science of social psychology shows us that actually the interpersonal part of self-awareness is the key. So self-awareness is fundamentally about other awareness. If you pay attention to how you impact others, you can adjust your behavior to make a good impression on others, and that will make you more effective. Again, go to an interview and you think an interview, you might be tempted to think, is an invitation to be honest and truthful. No, it isn't. An interview is a test of your ability to display social skills. If you tell people what you really think or what your real weaknesses are, you'll be unemployable. If, however, you say, oh, you know, I'm a compulsive perfectionist and sometimes I strive for quality so much that my work is late, but then in the end I deliver high value, it's like, oh, wow, I don't fully believe you or believe you for a second, but you seem quite socially skilled.
How can you bring your best self to work while being strategically authentic? Why can being your authentic self backfire at work and in life? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Over the past 3 years, I've had the privilege of speaking with more than 150 world-class CHROs and HR thought leaders on this podcast. Those conversations have revealed something every HR leader is grappling with. How do we stay ahead, create value, and truly future-proof our organizations? And that's exactly why I created my keynote, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow. It's not just a talk, it's a roadmap for transforming HR into a true value creator. I've had the privilege of keynoting HR leadership conferences for Fortune 500 companies, including AbbVie, Corning, Kohler, Nike, and LabCorp, and many more, equipping their teams with practical frameworks to challenge orthodoxies, sharpen influence, and build the capabilities that matter most for the future. If you're planning your next HR conference or leadership event, visit futureofhr.com to learn more, and let's talk about how we can make your next event a real success. And with that, my guest this week is Tomas Shamiro-Premusic. Tomas is an international authority on people analytics, talent, and leadership. He's a former chief innovation officer at Manpower Group, a professor of business psychology at University College of London and Columbia University. And he's the author of 10 books, including his latest, the one we'll be discussing today, Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. Tomas and I have known each other for a long time, and he's been a big supporter of the podcast. So it was an honor and fun to have him back to talk about why being authentic is overrated, the four traps leaders fall into when they decide just to be themselves, how reputation, not self-perception, determines success, why you are always a work in progress, and what happens when you stop evolving, and why feedback is the key to self-awareness and personal growth. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Tomas. Tomas, welcome to the Future of HR Podcast. Welcome back for second time, maybe. Third time? I don't know. We'll get you back next time.
Yeah, maybe it's the third, but the important thing, JP, is that it's not the last.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, exactly. No, well, you got so many more books than you.
Exactly.
And you are one of my favorite authors, especially around really looking at like psychology, confidence, leadership, competence. There's just like, if we had a Venn diagram of your books, I think that would almost hit it. And you just have done another bang up job on this book, Don't Be Yourself, which is a controversial and intriguing title. So I'm curious, though, what made you decide to take on this idea of being authentic, especially when being authentic is so popular right now?
Yeah, I tell you, I think it's a couple of things. The first is I realize that I tend to get obsessed with topics where the mainstream view has become so nonsensical that even a commonsensical approach to it or to them is heretic or controversial. So it was the same with my book about confidence is not that important. Can we focus on competence? Then the incompetent men in leadership jobs. And now this one, I mean, that's the main one, right? Like when I see a huge gap or abyss between science and practice or evidence and mainstream views, that keeps me up at night. And I try to do something to kind of bridge that gap. The second one, paradoxically, is that I'm not opposed to the idea that authenticity would be a nice thing to have. Who wouldn't like to or wouldn't want to live in a world where you can just show up at work, dress like you want, tell your boss whatever you think, or go to an interview and you get the job if you're fully honest and transparent, as opposed to display some social skills or adhere to the etiquette. But if we're really telling people that that's the world we live in, we're doing a disservice to a lot of people, especially, I know you care a lot about young people going into HR, but young people in general, we're really not educating people who are entering the job market. And I tell this story in the book, and I have told this story to my friends. Somebody who worked in my team or my reporting line who once came to see me for a career kind of coaching conversation, really, really high-performing guy, wearing a t-shirt, just be you, they will adjust. I couldn't let it go. And he's a great guy. He takes on feedback very well. So I said, do you realize just how narcissistic that is? One of two things. Either you think we should all wear that t-shirt and then society doesn't function. There is no society if none of us understand where our right to be ourselves ends and our obligation to others begins. It's just anarchy or medieval barbarian times. Or perhaps you think you should be the only person who wears that t-shirt and everybody else should adjust to you, which is definitely the most narcissistic thing in the world. I'm trying to tackle this authenticity cult because A, is very hypocritical, and B, it's not at odds with reality. So it's just an attempt to depict reality as it really is.
Yeah, and I think that's what's great about your books, because while someone may react to the title of Don't Be Yourself and can't wait for all the LinkedIn posts kind of saying that you're so wrong, when you read the book, to your point, we're going to talk about it, it makes a lot of sense, because you're not saying don't try to be who you think you are. But the reality is, like you said, where does being authentic and where do my obligations to others end? And I do want to know, what happened to that conversation with your team member who had that shirt? Did you guys have a conversation about it? Did he understand what that shirt was kind of communicating?
Yeah. So first, he was really surprised. And this is a smart guy with high IQ and high EQ. And he spends a lot of time reading materials, psychology, much. He probably listens to your podcast. Although if he had really listened to your podcast, maybe, you know, he'll be a little bit. He really has a voracious appetite and curiosity for consuming learnings and insights about people, work, organizational psychology, etc. But it had never occurred to him. He took it really well. I think he's not wearing the t-shirt anymore. And of course, like everything, I think you have to interpret the intention. The intention wasn't mean or evil. Again, the whole intention of the authenticity kind of a zeitgeist or cult, if you like, is a positive one. I mean, after all, especially if you are a member of the out-group or a diverse individual, it's far fairer and better to encourage you to express yourself and to have relatively small psychological distance between your personal and professional self. The problem, again, is if we encourage people to do that, and then when they share their unconventional hobbies or interests with others, they get punished for it, then we're not being real.
Yeah. I mean, that's an important point. I think that's probably why it has had so much momentum and people really respond to it, is to your point that we don't want to have this cognitive dissonance of where we think we are and how we want to behave versus how we're showing up. And it's obviously it feels better to be closer to that. But in the real world, not all of us can do that. We're going to talk about the four traps that you lay out in your book. Trap one is always be honest. Talk about more why absolute honesty can backfire in leadership and career growth.
Yeah. unless you're Donald Trump or Elon Musk, you probably can't get away with telling people what you really think and not caring. Even, you know, Ray Dalio has this great TED Talk where he talks about radical transparency or radical candor at Bridgewater, his company. Company is very successful, right? And even in his TED Talk, he says, we always tell each other what we think and feel. But there are some exceptions. Like if one of my employees shows up after having a baby and is showing me a picture of their baby, newborn baby, we don't say, hey, your baby is really ugly. Okay, that's good. Some empathy is there. But more often than not, if you want to be trusted and if you want to be considered a nice colleague and somebody who is rewarding to deal with, you will have to understand that at times there are benefits of speaking your mind and telling people what you really think. And at times there are severe kind of drawbacks. My 5-year-old understands when to pretend that he liked the cake or the present. And certainly my 8-year-old understands how to behave when she goes to somebody else's house and how she behaves at home. Good. Let's not lose that ability when we are grown-ups at work. White lies are one of the foundations of prosocial behavior. And of course, you have to learn to read between the lines. If you're my colleague and you ask me, Tomas, how was my presentation? I'm going to tell you, JP, you suck. I mean, that will show I have no EQ. I don't care about you. And even if I want to give you negative feedback, there are constructive ways of doing it. And again, you know, whatever happened to being nice to your neighbor and smiling to him or her and then bitching about them when you're at home? It worked for centuries, if not millennia. Let's keep it that way.
Yeah, because I mean, part of this idea of being authentic is like, I've got to be honest. I have to tell you how I feel. I've got to basically let everyone know that I'm being candid, transparent. But Tomas, your points here are really valid. So what's a better alternative to just tell the truth when we are navigating difficult conversations at work?
There is a skill or a skill set required and that needs to be finessed that entails communicating the message, communicating, let's say, negative or critical feedback that will make somebody better and that would help somebody be better, whether it's your employee. I mean, it could be your boss, right? I mean, after all, upward feedback is one of the best sources leaders get to develop and improve and increase their self-awareness. But the art consists in doing in such a way that people don't become defensive, that people don't take it personal, and that people learn that you mean it in a way that is intended to make them better. And that actually requires a lot of EQ. As you know, I have a whole section on EQ because generally people who love authenticity also love EQ. And actually they're inversely correlated. The best example of somebody with high EQ, emotional intelligence, would be a very skilled poker player, not somebody who lets you see right through them or who is pushing you to connect with their inner feelings or who is just broadcasting their unsolicited thoughts and emotions at work, which can be overbearing and tedious. So I'm not advocating for a Machiavellian attitude at work, being a phony or a fraud. But I am advocating for a certain level, a modicum of self-control. And generally speaking, the fact is that if you can manage your emotions and you can pay attention to what other people think of you and engage in strategic self-presentation, you will be more successful. And by the way, you will be more liked by your colleagues. So you can choose.
Yeah, exactly. I think you learned that the hard way. Some people talk about this as like, this is all about politics. I don't want to play politics. But we are social creatures and you're playing a social game, whether we want to or not. So your point is really valid around the career you want to have. And so the second trap you have is be true to your values and follow your heart, which sounds amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Tell us more about this value of like, be true to my values and following my heart, my passion.
I think this is the one that probably people think, how on earth can you disagree with that, right? How on earth can you rationally and realistically or authentically argue against people following their heart and being true to their values, their core beliefs, no matter what? It's like, well, I would say first, it depends what those values are, right? What if you're a fascist? What if you're a Nazi? What if you're an anti-Semite? Maybe you want to have a list of exemptions, but then you actually just want people to be true to their values if they are your values. which I think explains why we live in a world that is so polarized and so tribal. We seem to have lost the capacity to even talk to people who don't think like us. All I'm saying is that organizational cultures and societies at large would be a much better place if we can cultivate and harness the ability to question our own values, at least tolerate other people's values, and ideally see things from other people's perspective, as opposed to being rigidly tied to our own values. And let's face it, there are a lot of people with antisocial, toxic values who may still have good careers and okay or neutral effect in the workplace if they manage to keep those values in check and if they manage to fake it into being pro-social citizen. If you're a horrible person, please, please, please fake being nice. Being an authentic jerk is definitely worse than being an artificially or ingenuously or disingenuously polite or kind person, I think, in every culture. But that's the thing, right? We want our cake and we want to eat it as well. We want people to be really nice to us, but we want them to really, really mean it. Well, unfortunately, there's only 4 or 5 people in the world that can fit that mold. With the rest of people, you have to make compromises. Ideally, you don't assume that your values are the center of the universe and everybody is sort of like floating around you.
And I think as we're talking about this, I think it's important just to maybe, I had the revelation, I want to make sure we level set for everybody. When I think about this, and Tomas, please check me, when I think about the idea of like, I need to be authentic, in some ways, these traps are excuses I'm using to have maybe bad behavior, but just behave as I want to behave. And without a care for you in the world, right? To your point of like, well, I'm being authentic because these are my values. I'm following my heart. And this is what matters to me versus what maybe is important in that moment and situation. It's almost like a rationale we're using to be authentic.
Yeah. Justification. Yeah.
It's a justification, right? Yeah.
Which it sounds great, but it doesn't scale very well. There's another great book I recommend. I can't remember the author, but he's a Danish anthropologist. And the book is Infantilized. You can put it in your notes when you have it. It's a great book. It starts with this sort of like story of a woman who's having her performance review. Her manager says, you can see that I'm including HR material here because let's not forget it's an HR podcast. Her boss is saying, hey, you know, Jenny, you're doing really well. You exceeded the expectations. You're hitting all your numbers. I'm really happy with you. If I could just mention or highlight one opportunity in the euphemistic American HR language of talking about weaknesses, it'll be great if you can pay a little bit more attention to your emails, especially when you communicate with clients, because oftentimes you just misspell things and it might suggest that you're a bit sloppy and low, you know, not conscientious. It's like misspelled what? And it says, you know, like this source. And the employee says, but that's how I spell it. Okay, well, but you know, it's incorrect. No, that's how. And then the story continues. She gets home, complains to her parents, and then the mother calls the boss and says, how dare you tell my daughter off for how she spells it? This seems funny and ludicrous, but it is the real world. It is the real world. It just doesn't scale very much if we all behave as we are the center of the universe and expect other people to adjust to us.
That's an amazing example. Another example that kind of popped in this section around be true to your values and follow your heart is that leaders sometimes are really operating from emotions rather than reason. And I'm curious, as we think about the leaders we work through, it's almost like, hey, I'm passionate about this. This is my values. We're making this decision for these reasons. But how do we coach managers who pride themselves on being authentic leaders, but they're really making emotion-driven choices?
Yeah, great question. If you actually look at the academic or technical research on authentic leadership, it actually has very little to do with the mainstream connotation or notion of authenticity. Mostly they're talking about charismatic leaders. And by that, they mean leaders who can tune into other people's emotions and elicit warmth, etc., which is a skill. Jeffrey Pfeffer in Leadership BS has a whole section on why being authentic is the worst thing a leader can do, in the sense of like, if there is a crisis and you're freaking out internally, do you want to have a meltdown or do you want to try to keep everybody cool-headed and so on? On the subject of values, which you raise, the main danger is that even if you're in a position of power and there isn't a minimum level of maturity that nudges people to think for themselves about things in the world, because we glamorize or worship leaders. So it's the cult kind of version of leaders. And it's like, I love Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or whoever that is, Angela Merkel. So basically whatever she's, or I love Taylor Swift and Ariana Grande. So if they say something about the Middle East or Russia, etc., I'm going to align with them. And if I don't agree with them, I'm going to stop listening to them in Spotify, right? Even if there was a maturity where people think for themselves, which isn't the case, when you're in a position of power and you're a role model and you basically feel like you have to tell people how you think and feel about all these issues, you're bound to alienate and divide. The only safe option is to focus on work as opposed to, and of course, it's very tempting to say, what do you think about the upcoming elections or situation in the Middle East or China, etc., or LGBT or diversity. But if you do that, you're just expecting people who think like you to work for you. I mean, you basically want a cult. The only mature position in how you would coach or advise leaders is like, remember, you're supposed to value having people from diverse backgrounds and different walks of life, because that's where innovation happens. If you can bring together people who are different and they're not all the same, and actually what you're doing it is inadvertently suppressing that. You might tell people to bring their whole self to work, but actually what you're saying is they have to think like you.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to remember, as a leader, what your role is to help drive results, get things done, build followership, right, for an ultimate goal, not to talk about what happened on the news yesterday, right?
Correct. And in order to drive results, you probably need to have the ability to discern what you say and what you don't say, and to have some boundaries between your personal opinions and your professional self.
I don't think a lot of us really, the true whoever we really are deep down, our family knows that. But they may not love it either. We all have to be a little bit inauthentic, you know, in our own ways. But that doesn't mean you're not being who you are. I think that's kind of the point. And we touched on the next trap a little bit already, which is don't worry about what others think. But let's just underline why ignoring others' opinion is not only unrealistic, but it's actually harmful.
Yeah, it's amazing that it almost has become like a sign of insecurity to suggest that you are adjusting your behavior based on what other people think. It's like, oh my God, you're like a loser if you do this, right? I think it actually starts like, probably the philosophical roots are Jean-Paul Sartre taking on the establishment. By the way, while he was sipping his cognac or fine wines, smoking Gauloises in an intellectual cafe in Paris, right? And comes from a very bourgeois family, but it's like, basically stick it to the man and think for yourself and be a contrarian. It's a little bit like people who wear Che Guevara t-shirts now. If the Che was alive, he would shoot himself for seeing how he has been kind of weaponized and sort of productized. The essence of self-awareness, which we all love, is not introspection, but is other awareness. If you want to understand yourself, which you said, it's very difficult to know who you really are. If you're a psychoanalyst, you say, you know, you have to do 10 years of therapy. And in the end, there are two options. You're either neurotic and therefore you understand that there is no answer, or you're psychotic and you think you're Napoleon or somebody very famous, Winston Churchill. But the science of social psychology shows us that actually the interpersonal part of self-awareness is the key. So self-awareness is fundamentally about other awareness. If you pay attention to how you impact others, you can adjust your behavior to make a good impression on others, and that will make you more effective. Again, go to an interview and you think an interview, you might be tempted to think, is an invitation to be honest and truthful. No, it isn't. An interview is a test of your ability to display social skills. If you tell people what you really think or what your real weaknesses are, you'll be unemployable. If, however, you say, oh, you know, I'm a compulsive perfectionist and sometimes I strive for quality so much that my work is late, but then in the end, I deliver high value. It's like, oh, wow, I don't fully believe you or believe you for a second, but you seem quite socially skilled. Paying attention to others has two benefits. One, you will know what behaviors are going to be rewarded and which ones are not. And by the way, if you overdo it, there is a punishment for that as well. You know, people who always mention your name, like Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People too much. So it's like, hey, JP, yes, how are you, JP? And how are you, JP? And it's like, you know, that's overdoing it. It looks fake. Or the poor waiter or waitress who engages in such artificial emotional labor that you're like, come on, have a break and relax, be yourself. But the opposite, which is just truly imposing your uncensored and unfiltered self on others, doesn't work. So that's a disadvantage. Second one, if you focus more on others, you'll come across as more humble and less narcissistic. That's generally a good thing in every culture, including LA.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. We really should be thinking about other focused and thinking about who we're working with, how we can help them. I mean, I think that's, we are our best when we're doing that. But when you talk to this idea of don't worry about others and what others think, it always makes me think about Hogan, where Hogan would say, you don't have a personality, you have a reputation. Because it's not so much about what I think my personality is, it's about what you would say it is. That's a big distinction. And it changes people's mindset. I'm like, it doesn't matter what you think. It's what do you think people are saying about you when you're not in the room? And are you trying to manage that? That is, to me, the key.
You might love your self-view and your self-concept. It's generally better to have a high self-esteem than a low self-esteem. And by the way, most people, even outside America, have an inflated self-esteem relative to kind of their actual accomplishments. And that's okay. The optimism bias is a universal theme. Having said that, the reality is that we all get hired, fired, promoted, and demoted, not for what we think of ourselves, but for what other people think of us. And granted, sometimes being deluded can be contagious. Being insecure can be contagious. But sooner or later, somebody who actually understands how good you are will take a good look at you. It's better to know what they think and to understand the gap between your self-views and your reputation than not. Erwin Goffman, who is the father of sociology by most accounts, talked about interaction being the essence of any kind of human action, whether it's a real interaction with others or an interaction we're recreating or modeling in our head. And he made it very clear 60, 70 years ago, like, life is like a theater stage. We're always acting, even when we think we're not. There are two types of acting. One is what he calls deep acting, where you truly believe your professional self or the person you create and display to others. You're like a method actor. You're in character, right? The other is surface acting, where like you don't believe it and you feel like a fraud or a fake because you can't bullshit yourself. The second one is less effective, but the first one is as close we can get to the idea of authenticity. The salesperson who has bullshitted themselves into having the best product in the world, they will come across as authentic, but it doesn't mean that they're being genuine or that they're going to sell you something that is good.
Yeah. So that self-delusion, us believing that, becomes a great salesman because we're so confident in that versus people who are a little bit more, like you said, trying to take on that personality, on that role. It's harder, right? Because you feel through that. You can see it's not as authentic, but that's why people are so, these narcissistics can be so compelling when they really believe those delusions, right? And they think that's being authentic and they can match who they're selling to or that audience, whatever. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah. By the way, an important footnote, since you have a PhD in IO psychology and care about science, as you will know, there is no way of knowing how authentic somebody is. So for example, ask the question, who's more authentic, Obama or Trump? There is just no empirical or scientific way to answer that question. You could start to say, well, let's look at whether what they say is truly what they think. Okay, we need Neuralink, and also what they think might be kind of a delusion itself. Oh, let's see the difference between their professional and private self. I'm sure neither of them behave at home like they behave in public. We'll have to ask Michelle and Melania, right? But is that the real them, or are they acting in front of them? We just don't know. So authenticity is in the eye of the beholder or in the audience. And a lot of research shows that the people who are deemed authentic, they tend to have high EQ, they're charismatic, and they display your values. In other words, people will find Trump authentic if they agree with his views, and people will find Obama authentic if they agree with his. If you ask the Trump voter how authentic Obama is, he'll say, he isn't, he's a fraud and a phony, and vice versa. So there's no empirical way to answer that question, which makes the concept flawed from a kind of scientific perspective.
Yeah, I think maybe, again, Tomas, tell me if I'm wrong on this one, but there's also not really a way to tell if someone's lying. We don't know if someone's lying, right? Or giving a false sense of embellishing the resume, telling us what we want to hear. We really don't know that. We're really bad at that, actually, even though people believe there's like telltale signs for lies and all those things, right?
Even already with kids, it's like, did you eat the last cookie? No, I didn't, says your 5-year-old son. It's like, Does he actually believe he didn't, or is he lying? We don't know. So you can be truthful according to your own recollection, but you're lying, or you can be engaging in deception. We tend to care a little bit too much about people's intention and who they are deep down. It would be better if we just cared about their behavior and what they do. At the end of the day, if I work with you, you're always nice to me and kind to me. Why do I care that you might hate me deep down? If you continue lying to me and faking it all the time, you're going to be a good friend. <You know? laughs> We're not going to talk about marriages, but I think with marriages, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Maybe your wife or your spouse doesn't really love you, but she's gotten into the habit of pretending. And it's like the alternatives maybe are more risky and not as solid.
Well, there's one last quote, and then we're going to move on to some advice for HR leaders, but from David Bowie in the book that just grabbed me. And he once said, "I am only the person the greatest number of people think I am."
Yeah.
I love that quote. I mean, that kind of sums up what we've been talking around here.
I know. Are you a Bowie fan?
I mean, yeah, a little bit. He's a little bit before my time, but like some of the music and what he did, just, I saw a lot of it, but it wasn't like, I wasn't fully in the 70s child that way.
Yeah. So if we have, since you appeal to a younger audience, so, just for them to know that, well, first of all, we're talking about somebody who is artistically at the antipodes or opposite side of the spectrum of Ed Sheeran, but this will get me killed now because I'm talking about my kind of musical taste. No, I mean, David Bowie was a creative genius and he had this ability to not just jump from one genre to another between one year and the next and have a soul record, a rock record, an electronic record, an ambient record, a jazz, a funk record, whatever. But with each album, he would create a new artistic persona. So Ziggy Stardust and other characters. And at some point, the BBC journalist said, "But who are you really?" Because, his professional persona changed all the times. And he said, "I am only the person the largest number of people think I am." Obviously, he was a big HR fan and loved 360-degree feedback. Clearly, he had gone through a lot of multi-source feedback. I've coached leaders who said, "You speak very highly of 360, but can you recommend something else? Because I didn't have very good experiences with them personally." Maybe you should pay a bunch of people to say nice things about you or continue to believe you are much better than what people say. But really, you are in the eyes of others, and our reputation can be crowdsourced if we ask people what they think. And actually, because we inhabit multiple selves, and there is this beautiful thing called self-complexity. If you want to know who you are, you have to ask your kids, your spouse, your colleagues, your boss, your former boss. And only then can you make a collage or stitch together the different fragments of your identity. And by the way, even if people tell you to bring your whole self to work, please only bring the relevant aspects of yourself and leave the bad ones at home. And I do feel sorry for the people who are at home because you're leaving them with your dark side. But anyway, they're probably used to it by now.
Well, that's the question I wanted to talk to you about. So how can HR leaders use feedback, especially that uncomfortable feedback, to become better versions of themselves? Like, what career advice do you have for HR leaders, Tomas?
Feedback is the main source we have for self-awareness, for understanding who we are according to others and accessing our professional self or reputation. And if you don't know really how others see you, you will probably not have an incentive to get better and change. So actually, feedback can encourage you, if you're a leader or anybody, to go against your nature and to be less stuck or more unstuck in your authentic self. Because as you said, this idea that, well, this is how I do it and I do it like that and like the world should adjust to me actually limits you. So feedback can help leaders become a richer, more diverse or heterogeneous version of themselves, which is, I think, how we evolve. We evolve by learning habits or tendencies that are not naturally ingrained in us. And if I see leaders who are really, really good at what they do, and you look at their personality scores, you don't recognize them in those scores because they learn to go against their nature. Leaders are always a work in progress. A leader who says, "I'm a finished product," is basically finished.
Well said. Great advice. Tomas, my last question for you, were you authentic during this conversation? We want to know, were you the real Tomas?
I think I was, and that's maybe the paradox, but I like to say that irrespective of what my intention is, when I write a book and where I'm coming from, I try to make the evidence speak. As I said in the beginning, I'm not opposed to the idea that people could live in a world in which they feel less pressure to conform. And in fact, if you think about America, the great still strength of America is that it enables people to display very random, nonconformist, and unconventional behaviors. For the 1% of people who succeed, that can be an incredible source of progress and innovation. For the other 99%, okay, maybe it's like, but I think we have to be reasonable and rational. And I am being authentic. My only main take or kind of pet hate with the subject is that demands or commands or suggestions to be authentic are not authentic at all.
Well said. Well, I have known you for a while. I thought you were authentic. We've had a great relationship. Whether you like me or not, I appreciate you returning my phone calls, come on the podcast, and continue to write books that I think inspire all of us and make us think.
And I plan to keep pretending and faking it forever, JP. So, you know, you will never really truly know what I really think of you.
I love it. Tomas, thanks for being on the podcast. Great conversation. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. A big thank you to Tomas for joining me and sharing his insights on his latest book, Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. It was a fascinating read that challenges the way we think about authenticity, reputation, and leadership. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of my past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to get my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Tina Gupta. Tina is the SVP of Talent Management at New York Life Insurance, where she's leading organization-wide transformation at the intersection of talent and AI. New York Life is one of the companies who is truly integrating AI into their culture and how they operate. With 12,000 employees trained on it and thousands of custom GPTs built internally, Tina is going to share why she believes AI adoption is not about technology as much as it is about managing change. You will not want to miss this conversation. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.